May it please the court?
This
is sort of an unusual case in that relator and respondent agree on a number of things and facts in this case, two of which are that the Board of Probation and Parole is not calculating compliance credits correctly, but we also agree that the Board of Probation's calculation of those compliance credits is not appealable. I'm certainly happy to answer any questions that this court has about the issuance of compliance credits, because I believe that Mr. Hennen was shortchanged on his compliance credits, but I don't believe that issue is before this court. And further, even with the shortchanged amount of compliance credits as of April 1st, 2015, respondent has not complied with the statute, section 559.016, because for respondent to have statutory authority to revoke Mr. Hennen's probation, every reasonable effort needed to be expended to hold the probation revocation hearing before April 1st, 2015. Another key fact that respondent and relator agree on in this case is that after the state filed its no bond warrant and sent it to the state of Pennsylvania on February 20th, 2015, the state of Missouri did not do anything until it received notice on April 6th, 2015. And relator believes that while there could certainly be a continuum of what would be reasonable efforts to bring Mr. Hennen back to the state of Missouri in order to have the probation revocation hearing, on one end, we would have the state do nothing, and on the other hand, we would have every employee of the state of Missouri trying to go get Mr. Hennen and bring him back here. And in this particular case, we're simply on the side where the state of Missouri didn't do anything. And thus, as a matter of law, relator did not, every reasonable effort was not expended to bring Mr. Hennen back and hold this probation revocation hearing before his probation expired.
In effect, the state argues that until it got a notification by Pennsylvania that he was available, that reasonable efforts didn't start. It didn't have to do any. It didn't have to act until it got that notification that he was available, and so we shouldn't count that 6 weeks against them.
Well, I think probably the easiest answer is that the state was obviously aware of the fact that April 1st was the deadline for Mr. Hennen's probation.
Well, what could they have done to get him back, absent some agreement or him being released on his sentence he was serving?
As the state did ultimately produce that teletype, clearly the state of Missouri and the state of Pennsylvania had some manner of communicating with each other. Sometime during the month and a half after the no bond warrant was filed, the state of Missouri certainly could have simply sent a teletype asking the prosecutors in Pennsylvania, what's going on with Mr. Hennen's new drug charge in Pennsylvania? Is he going to be available to be sent back before April 1st? Some sort of information to figure out what was going on, particularly in that obviously relator believes that the state of Missouri was aware that Mr. Hennen could be picked up on February 20th, given the fact that the no bond warrant was filed on the exact last possible second before Pennsylvania was going to release Mr. Hennen. But even if not, the state of Missouri was aware that that deadline was coming up.
So you're saying they knew his probation would end even under the miscalculated date in April 1, so whatever their obligation was, they couldn't just sit on their hands and let it pass. They had to make some efforts in order to comply with the reasonable efforts standard.
Correct, and I think that's especially important given that under the interstate compact for bringing Mr. Hennen back, the state of Pennsylvania was only required to keep Hennen until either March 20th or March 22nd, depending on when you start that clock, such that if the state of Pennsylvania hadn't gone above and beyond its duty and simply would have let Mr. Hennen go on March 22nd, then he wouldn't have been available to be sent back to Missouri. And in fact, not only did Pennsylvania go above and beyond and keep him for longer than necessary, but they sent him off to the Pennsylvania State Penitentiary, where the penitentiary didn't know what to do with him, so they put him in isolation because he wasn't classified as any kind of Pennsylvania offender. And so on March 31st, he gets put in isolation and spends a couple of days in isolation in a Pennsylvania state penitentiary because the state of Missouri was simply sitting on its hands as opposed to asking Pennsylvania what they're doing and going
to get him. But why isn't the warrant enough of an asking them, where you have a no-bond warrant, you send it to them, why is that not a sufficient demand for his return that you should expect they would comply and that you would be able to return him as soon as they tell you they're ready to release him from their custody?
Well, I think that probably was enough that Missouri could have then followed up and sent agents to go pick up Mr. Hennen, but they didn't.
Well, but don't they have to know he is ready to be released?
I think, you know, obviously the relator disagrees that Missouri didn't know that he was available for release, but even if it was Pennsylvania's responsibility to let Missouri know, I don't think, or as a matter of law, you can't reach every reasonable effort by simply doing nothing when you know your deadline is coming past.
Could the judge, in lieu of a no bond warrant, could the judge just send a letter saying, you have an obligation to appear here as soon as you're released? Would that have satisfied the requirement? Take every reasonable effort?
Send a letter like that to Mr. Hennen?
Sure.
That could be a possibility, especially under the circumstance if Pennsylvania didn't still have him in prison. Obviously, this is a situation where Mr. Hennen was picked up on a drug charge and was in Pennsylvania prison. The interstate compact, I guess, makes it easier for the transmission of Mr. Hennen back here to the state of Missouri when he's incarcerated. Obviously, if he was released, you know, the state of Missouri certainly could have noticed up their hearing for March 15th and told Mr. Hennen that he needed to be here for that hearing.
How did the state know to send the no-bond warrant right at the time he was getting released?
I wish I knew the answer to that. Mm-hmm. Mr. Hennen filed discovery requests. The respondent, Judge Rolfe, asked the state for information regarding communications between the state, and up until the state finally produced the teletype, the state insisted that it didn't have access to any of this information, despite the fact that this court's decision in Meriwether requires the state to go out and figure out if there is this sort of information and then tell defendants as to whether that information exists. Obviously, at this point, the state is saying that the teletype on April 6th is the only and first communication they received from Pennsylvania. Obviously, in the situation where the state has said they don't have anything and then later produce something, relator is at least a little concerned when the last possible second the state of Missouri issues the no bond warrant, because up until that point the state of Missouri was made aware of this probation violation sometime between January 1st and January 15th.
So we know there was some communication.
Obviously we know that there was the communication about the field the violation report,
right,
that went to the probation office. Mm-hmm. And then as far as what's been produced in this case, nothing until all of a sudden on the last possible date, February 20th, the state of Missouri sends the no bond warrant. And then the rest of the facts before this court show that allegedly nothing happened until April 6th.
Except he was being held only on the bond for 6 weeks with no action.
After February 20th, the only reason that he was being held in Pennsylvania was Missouri's no bond warrant. The state has argued that somehow he's being held under Pennsylvania law, and that means that he wasn't only held on the no bond warrant, but Pennsylvania was holding him because Missouri sent the no bond warrant, and then under Pennsylvania law, they continued to hold him. It wasn't as if he was being held for any other reason, because when he pled on February 18th to the new charges in Pennsylvania, he was sentenced to an additional term of probation, and the court's order states under Pennsylvania law that he's to be released within 48 hours. And at that point, Pennsylvania had no reason to hold him except for receiving the no bond warrant on February 20th.
Who has the burden of proof? To prove that every reasonable effort was made? Is it your responsibility to prove that it wasn't, or is it the state's responsibility to prove that they made every reasonable effort to hold a hearing within the time?
Honestly, Your Honor, I don't remember what the burden is there.
Is that obligation, is the obligation the judges or is the obligation the states?
The obligation is on both. This court in Strasser certainly focused on the judge's obligation because the judge in Strasser kind of over the state's, the prosecutor's objection, kept continuing the hearing so that the offender would have time to pay.
What in the statute suggests that the obligation to use reasonable efforts belongs to anybody other than the judge?
So the statute just simply says that in order for the trial court to be able to revoke probation, quote, every reasonable effort is made to conduct the revocation hearing prior to the expiration of the probation period.
The introductory provision, it speaks to the power of the court, mm-hmm. not the power of the state to successfully revoke or the power of the state and the court, but the statute is about the power of the court.
Well, it's the court's authority to revoke the probation, but that requires the state in the form of the prosecutor to continue to make efforts to get him back and have the probation revocation.
But I think
well, if they don't
question.
Prove their, if they don't prove their violations, they don't prove their violations. I mean, the judge is not a party to the case. It looks like what could this judge have done other than issue the no bar warrant?
Well, there's authority of this court in the Western District that if the court is not happy with the pace at which the parties are moving the case forward, they can enter orders ordering the parties to meet particular milestones to move a case forward. If it was the judge's responsibility, certainly he could have issued an order saying the state needs to get him back by March 15th or file an explanation of why we're not having this hearing before April 1st, 2015. Again, that's the minimum possible effort that I can imagine right now, but that also wasn't done in this particular case.
That's kind of an interesting mix between the state not providing the information and it's the court's responsibility to make every reasonable effort.
Well, the state did file the field violation report, which notes that the April 1st, 2015 deadline is coming up. And so
when did the state file that?
February 2nd of 2015.
And that was how I got the warrant? Or?
No, the warrant came after the state moved for to revoke Mr. Hennon's probation, which also happened on February 20th.
So the court was aware there was a motion to revoke probation in February and was aware that probation ended in April. And did the court do anything during that interim period to set a hearing?
I don't believe that there was no hearings were set or anything.
What the court did was suspend the probation and enter an order of no bond. Enter an order suspending probation.
I don't think that Mr. Hennon's probation was ever actually suspended. I think the court simply entered the necessary order to create the no bond warrant for Mr. Hennon. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Scott Eisen. I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney in Lafayette County, and I represent the respondent in this case, the Honorable Dennis Rawl. I believe the real issue in this case is whether the court made every reasonable effort to conduct a hearing on the pending probation violations under Section 559.036.8 prior to the expiration of the defendant's probation. Under that section, there's basically three criteria that the court has to meet in order to revoke a defendant's probation after his probation has expired. I don't believe that there's any doubt that the first two conditions were met in this case.
But did you set a hearing?
No. In this case, a hearing was not set. I believe the affirmative manifestation of the court's intent was his issuing the warrant, and I believe that's backed up by cases here in Missouri, because basically that's all the court can do. It can set a hearing, but it'd be almost a futile process when you don't even have the defendant within your jurisdiction.
But the court, could we have waited years and nothing been done? Could it have been, when he set the no bond warrant, did he get notice that this person had been picked up and what had happened in Pennsylvania. Can the court just issue the warrant and do nothing for years, and that's every reasonable effort, or do they have to do something else before the deadline? When it's here, he was aware it was coming up.
I believe that the court can only do what the court can do, and in this case, the only thing the court can do is issue the warrant in
well,
this case.
Or set a
when
hearing.
When he set a hearing?
It could set a hearing, but I don't believe, under the statute, there has to be personal service of a probation violation on the defendant. There has to be 5 days' notice. There are certain criteria that have to be met. I believe the Western District in the Stilgis case pretty much said that just inviting somebody to come before you is not the affirmative manifestation of the intent of the court. Issuing a warrant is the affirmative manifestation that the court intends to conduct that hearing. Just saying come to us is not the affirmative manifestation.
But the second, and I don't think anyone doubts that, it's the second part, making every reasonable effort.
That's correct, Judge.
That's in question. And so why is that enough to be every reasonable effort?
The warrant itself?
Yeah.
Because I believe that the statute makes it incumbent upon the court, and the court can only issue the warrant. The court can't send agents to another state. The court can't do anything else other than command through its warrants to the officers in the state of Missouri.
So if the prosecutor does nothing, for the court can just sit there and has no obligation to ensure that something is done before, or at least attempt to ensure. Is that a flaw in the system? Because surely the intent is so we know before the end it's evident that there be a hearing before the end of the probation period, or otherwise the court loses power.
I believe there are two separate things. The first one that we've discussed with the court. The second one is with the prosecutor's office or the state of Missouri. I believe that the state of Missouri does still have an obligation to bring the party before the court. As in every case, they are the plaintiff in the case. They have the obligation to prosecute their case. If they fail to prosecute their case, I believe the court could dismiss it for want of prosecution or take any other actions against the state if the state chooses not to fulfill its obligations. But I believe the statute specifically refers to the court. But, yeah, there are remedies against the state that the court can hold if the state just does not do its job. I don't believe that's the case here, and I can get to that here in a second.
Under the compact, generally, under the interstate compact, it would be 30 days after this warrant was issued. Is that right? That Pennsylvania would have an obligation to hold him at the end of whatever time they held him for. Under the compact, they would have an obligation to hold him for another 30 days?
That's correct.
Okay, so what would that date have been?
That date, I believe, would have been 30 days after the first date that the state was notified. The state was notified.
And that was what date? April?
The state was first notified that he was available for pickup on April 6, 2015.
Okay, so under the compact, then Pennsylvania would have been obligated to hold him until May 6th or 7th.
Approximately that, Judge.
When was he picked up?
He was picked up. I don't have the exact date when he was picked up, but he was back in the state of Missouri 4 days later on April 10th, 2015.
So within the 30 days at the compact?
Yes.
Isn't that some indication of reasonable efforts on behalf of the state?
I believe so, Judge. The state can only do what the state can do. We cannot send armed agents to another state to take a citizen of another state. Our states are sovereign from one another. We can't send armed agents to take somebody. That would be kidnapping. We can't especially not send armed agents to another state to take somebody from their correctional
system.
Well,
can you
either
issue a no-bond warrant and then not act on it so the person is held on your warrant indefinitely because you haven't come to pick him up?
No, Judge, and I believe the reason why is, you know, we know who handle these cases every day. We have a very short period of time to pick somebody up. And I think it was shown in this case through the exhibits that were submitted. We actually had 10 minutes.
No, you had six weeks from February 20. He was only being held on your warrant, and you did nothing. For that period, he was being held without bond on a Missouri warrant, and Missouri just let him sit there for 6 weeks. That's his objection.
Correct, but I believe what happened in this case through my contacts and also through the exhibits that were submitted in this case by the relator is he was actually being supervised in the state of Pennsylvania. The state of Pennsylvania had supervision over him, which means they could issue a warrant for him. That's what they did in this case. They issued a Pennsylvania warrant for him to be held on this Missouri charge of the violation of the probation. That's why he was held there, and that's why he was transferred to the Department of Corrections. And that's what the state and that's what the exhibits show in this case. And through my contact, that's also what's been shown in this case. I can't answer for the way Pennsylvania runs their system or what they do. But the fact of the matter is, once Missouri was first notified in this case that he was available to be picked up, we confirmed the warrant within 10 minutes. We arranged for transportation back to the state of Missouri, and he was in fact brought from Pennsylvania back to the state of Missouri within 4 days from the time the state of Missouri was first notified that he was available to be picked up from the Pennsylvania.
How do we have any confidence in the statements you make when the state did not appear to comply with discovery requests and that you had the best access to that information, and what happened is based on kind of a dribbling in of information?
I don't believe the state did not comply with the discovery request in this case. The request that was made in this case was under 2504. 2504 requires a court order and a showing of good cause. That was not noticed up until the first part of July and was set for a hearing then on July 20th. July 20th was the date that this court issued its preliminary writ. So the hearing on the motion for discovery, not to compel any discovery, the motion for discovery itself was never even heard by the court.
And you're talking about way before that. You're relying on what happened in this telex that went in April, that the court asked you, do you have any other documents you're relying on? And you said no. Said present anything you want to rely on. Opposing counsel presented documents the defense relied on. The state presented nothing. Only later, after the court had ruled, and I think it was, I'm not sure, was it on appeal when the telex suddenly appeared?
Right.
And why should we look at that at this point when you didn't produce it when the court asked what documents were there?
Judge, when the court asked to provide the background on the case, I don't know why the prosecutor on that case did not do it, and I can't answer for them. But I was not even aware, and I used to be a law enforcement officer, that we were still using teletypes to get communications back or forth. It wasn't until I started making some more communications with the Sheriff's Department and figuring out.
But that knowledge of the state is your knowledge. You don't get to segregate that out and say somebody else knew it, not me, because it's too easy to hide the ball. Our cases are very clear. Any knowledge in the hands of the state is knowledge of the prosecutor.
Correct, and that's why it's proper under a 2504 motion. And when the 2504 motion was filed, it was never noticed up until July. And then the hearing date wasn't until July 20th. It wasn't under 2503 that we're talking about for this teletype, though. It's under 2504. Our file is completely open, and I know there's some discussion that that's not permissible, that that's not an answer to discovery, but the Western District has says it is. Our file was completely open in this case. Everything we had was completely open. This particular teletype is under 2504. Which
is not required to be disclosed unless there's an order that says do so.
Yes, Judge. If we would have had it beforehand, we could have done it. But the reason for 2504 is documents that are not within our possession in the prosecutor's office, for us to know the documents, for us to be able to get those documents, and if necessary, get the court involved to get those documents. This was not within the prosecutor's office possession. This was within the Lafayette County 911 system. They were the ones in possession of those documents. That's why it's under 2504, not 2503.
Counsel, for purposes of my question, just forget everything that happened before April 20th. Okay, the trial judge has got the defendant there. He sets a hearing on the motion to revoke, a reasonable period of time out, but then it doesn't happen. And it's not set to happen for 90 days. How's that reason?
And Judge, I believe that's reasonable under several circumstances, because you have to look at who is attributable to the delay and were those delays reasonable. In this case, the defendant already had counsel, so this wasn't a continuation for counsel. But the first delay in this case came when the defendant in this case, through counsel, filed a motion to discharge his probation.
Well, that's not a delay. He did it because of the delay.
Right. He did it because of the delay, but at the very first hearing, the April 20th hearing, I believe, that's when the court could first take up that motion that was filed about 10 days later. It took up that motion on that day. It heard arguments on that day. The very first law day back in Lafayette County, once the defendant was back with inside the territorial jurisdictions of the respondent in this case. It took up that motion. It heard that motion. It wanted some more time to research and look at that motion. So it set it over till about 30 days
later. Well, that's the problem, though, because the court could have, I mean, the motion is just, regardless of the evidence, you can't revoke because it's too late. The court could have gone ahead, held the revocation hearing, received the evidence, and taken both questions under advisement so that ultimately he could either, you know, overrule the motion to dismiss and revoke, or grant the motion to dismiss and declare that probation is ended. But by taking it one step at a time, he invoked another 60 days, 45 to 60 days delay in a case that was already over the deadline. So everybody knew the question there was reasonable efforts. So how is that reasonable not to go ahead and hold the hearing itself, which is what the statute requires, absolutely the first time he said it?
And Judge, it all turns on the reasonableness of it. I guess from the state's perspective, the state and the respondent believes it was reasonable for the court to take this under advisement.
And the question is why? Why was it reasonable to take it under advisement rather than hold the hearing that day, whatever research had to be done later? But because the statute requires you to hold the hearing, not to make your decision.
And yes, Judge, it does require that. That's a very good question. It does require that it hold the hearing. And admittedly, the court could have held it on that day. It could have presented evidence. It could have heard it, because I don't think there's any dispute to the evidence in this case that he did commit a new law violation in Pennsylvania.
Has there ever been a hearing yet?
No, the hearing was set for the July 20th date, because the first continuance was based upon the respondent wanting to look at the evidence more and research it more. The second continuance was based upon what I believe was the affirmative manifestation of the defendant's attorney that she was going to seek a writ to stop the very hearing that he was trying to do.
Because it was past time.
Correct. And I believe they were all based, and if you look at who's attributable to them, just like the court would look in a disposition of detainer case, or the court would look in a case dealing with somebody's most fundamental rights to a speedy trial, you look at the reasonableness of any delay in these cases, and you decide who can be attributable to those delays, and what was the reason for those delays, and that's the reasonableness of it. I believe respondent believes that these were reasonable delays in this case in order for this to be adjudicated fully. Now, you know, I know in this case that the defendant wants to compare this a lot to this court's decision last year in Strauser versus Martinez. But, you know, this case is factually and legally different from that case in several different ways. The first part that we've already discussed on is the fact that in Strauser and Martinez, the defendant was before the court. The court just didn't take any action. And I believe that this court wrote that any time during that, the court could have taken action. That was not possible in this case until the defendant was back inside the state of Missouri so a hearing could be held. The second main difference between these two cases is that in this case, and I believe it's something we've previously discussed, is that the respondent just did not sit idly by continuing out these hearings in order for an outcome to happen, for somebody to pay restitution or for somebody to do something. That was not the purpose of the respondent's spot in this. He was not trying to get an outcome in the case. He was continuing them based upon motions or assertions that were made by the defendant in this case in order to have this case either over in one way or for the hearing to be held. Because in my opinion, the defendant in this case was affirmatively trying to prevent the very hearing that the respondent was trying to hold. And again, I believe we should focus on the reasonableness of it, as the statute requires, because the court has to have every reasonable effort in this case. You know, the first one is he wasn't inside the jurisdiction of the state of Missouri. It wasn't until he got back inside the jurisdiction that the court then did hold a hearing on the next law day in Lafayette County. There was another continuance based upon the affirmative manifestation by the defendant's attorney that she was going to seek a writ to stop that very hearing from being held. I believe when you look at all that, that is an affirmative manifestation by the court, and I'm out of time.
Thank you.
May it please the court, the teletype was covered under, you know, normal 25.03 discovery, except for Hennen asked for the 25.04 discovery just to kind of cover the basis.
Does 25.03 even apply to probation revocation here?
I think it applies to the whole. It's filed under the same case, and
it's
so
a civil. The probation revocation is a civil proceeding, right? It has certain, you might be entitled to the report, but what's the basis that the regular criminal procedure rule that applies prior to conviction applies to probation revocation proceedings?
I think,
are you familiar with eight cases that hold that?
My argument on that would be that because it's filed as part of the same criminal case and just the continuing obligation under the
rules. Well, I mean, there's all sorts of different rules that apply to probation revocation proceedings that don't apply to the criminal case. Mm-hmm. It's a civil proceeding, correct?
Did the state object that the discovery was inappropriate under 2503, or did it produce some things, or
no, it didn't,
or did it respond
it
at all?
It didn't object or respond at all, other than in the email saying that there was nothing. And I think that also kind of highlights the state's alleged open file policy is that they're now saying that, I mean, until a month or two ago, they didn't know that this teletype existed, so going and looking at the file wouldn't have, the teletype presumably wouldn't have been in there. Also, under the compact doesn't key that 30-day countdown off of when notice is sent. The compact keys that 30-day countdown when the offender is being held in custody solely on Missouri's warrant, which under Pennsylvania law would have been either February 18th or February 20th, based on the 48 hours later, which would mean that that 30 days would be up in March 20th, March 22nd, not sometime in May. The last thing I wanted to point out, as the state mentioned, the speedy trial cases are one where delays are often kind of analyzed among many different parties. And in this court, in Garcia versus Goldman, was a speedy trial case in which the police could have put the defendant's information into one of their pieces of software and found the defendant that was living openly in Chicago for 10 or 15 years. But they didn't. They found they could have done this in 2002. They just didn't. Sometime in 2009, a police officer put his information in and found him in Chicago, went to Chicago and retrieved the defendant and then put him on trial. And this court found that it was the trial court was violating the speedy trial rights of that defendant based on you know, the fact that the state hadn't taken action to go get him. And that's sort of analogous to the situation here, where the state, the respondent, the prosecutor are the ones that want to revoke Mr. Hennen's probation, and together they have a responsibility to take every reasonable effort. And in these circumstances, when no effort was expended, every reasonable effort can't possibly be met.
Counsel, before you go, May 18th, that's the second time they all appear in front of the respondent. The respondent denies the motion to dismiss. Mm-hmm. It sounds to me like the state is arguing that they were prepared to go forward on that day with the revocation hearing, but it was defendant's counsel who asked for a further delay in order to seek a writ to prevent the hearing from going forward. Is that your understanding as well?
It is not. First of all, even if it had been, the Strasser case pretty clearly says that even when the court is specifically granting continuances for the defendant, that doesn't matter. Second of all, it's quoted in the brief. I don't have it open to it, but there was no mention of the writ at the beginning of the hearing, and the court ultimately says something to the effect of, I'm going to go ahead and deny the motion, but what I'm going to do is give you 30 days to go get a writ, something like that, and then asks how long the trial counsel would need to notice up the writ and have that happen. And that's where the July 20th date came from. So,
what was the reason? I'm sorry.
Was everybody prepared to go forward with the revocation hearing on the 18th, the motion to dismiss having now been denied, until the question of, you know, time to seek a writ arose by whomever it was mentioned?
I'm sorry, I don't think I understood that.
Well, after he denies the motion to dismiss, mm-hmm. was everybody prepared to go forward with the revocation hearing that was set on that day?
Well, I believe Ms. Peters was the trial attorney, and she was there with Colin Hennen. And as far as I know, yes, she was ready to go. The state has said that they were ready to go. Obviously, Hennen didn't believe the court had authority to move forward, and when the court mentioned it was going to do a writ, then we took that opportunity to go and file at the Western District to obtain the writ.
How did the delay occur between the April 20 hearing and that May 18 hearing? Did the defense ask for that delay?
I don't remember exactly what happened at that hearing, but I know that the motion to dismiss had been filed and the court was going to take it under consideration, and that was when the court asked for the parties, the state and the Hennen's attorney, to file anything that might help shed some light on what kind of communications happened and some information about the compact. And so I think the court just felt it needed more time to think about the motion.
Again, had the motion been denied on April 20, were the parties prepared to proceed to the hearing?
I believe so. Again, Mr. Hennon was there, and Shelley was prepared and could have gone forward with the hearing at that point. I don't, certainly there's no mention on the record of, that I recall, of either party saying they weren't ready to go forward. I believe it was Hennon just saying that you can't go forward.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Case will be submitted.
Thank you.